Hello and welcome to the Genetics Podcast. I'm your host, Patrick Short. My background is in population genomics and studying the genetic causes of rare disease. I did my PhD at the Sanger Institute in the University of Cambridge and have been in biotech since 2018 when I started Sonogenetics. Sonogenetics helps academic and industry researchers to run large-scale genetic testing programs that speed up their clinical trials, generate data sets for the next big breakthrough, and give participants the best possible experience taking part in research. Each episode of the Genetics Podcast, we bring you insights from the leading minds in genetics and precision medicine, including household names and Nobel Prize winners, as well as early career scientists and biotechs working on the next big breakthrough. Whether you are a scientist, entrepreneur, executive, patient advocate, or simply someone curious about how genetics shapes our world, you're in the right place. Thank you for listening, and let's get started. Welcome, everyone, to the Genetics Podcast. And George Church, thank you so much. I think I could talk to you for 100 hours and we would still have lots to cover. So we're going to try to do our best in 45 or 50 minutes today. I was wondering, you know, there's tons of things people can watch, TED Talks, they can read all sorts of things that you've done. What are the one or two things that you're working on right now that you're really excited about that don't quite have the coverage yet or that you think could be big in the next couple of years that are important projects to you?
Well, they might not have the coverage because they don't deserve the coverage, but I'll mention them anyway. Kind of pet projects that will probably languish for years, just like our elephant project languished for decades before it got money. One of them is the idea of making a box that can turn electricity into almost anything. I teach a course called How to Grow Almost Anything at Harvard, MIT, and globally. And the idea is to make this box that maybe sits in your kitchen and makes food initially from electricity, assuming that electricity becomes abundant from a variety of sources and is more efficient in a photon if it comes from photons. Yep. Anyway, this box will address issues of supply chain, possibility of pandemics where you really don't want to open your door, and it will achieve what hasn't happened yet in the International Space Station nor in submarines, which is full recycling. Anyway, that's one pet thing.
What makes full recycling so hard? Like, why? What is the heart of the problem there?
Part of it is people just haven't thought about, you know, electricity as being more abundant than farmland. And also some of the organisms we're working on have extraordinary doubling times, like 10,000, 20,000 times faster than corn. And so that means that the footprint can be shrunk. And anyway, so they just, you just haven't thought about electricity being, in some cases, an easier supply chain than other things.
Right.
Less disruptible. Geothermal, local solar, so forth.
Fusion, maybe.
And fusion, yep. Yeah. Right. So the other problem is we can do full recycling for animals. It's just humans are a little more fastidious about, you know, but we think that we're not eating poop when we're eating poop all the time, you know, the nematode usually. So. That kind of thing, you know. So
that's project number one. And what's project number two?
Number two is bioweather maps. So this is something we're working on since the turn of the millennium. And the idea is to enable people in participatory science where they, you know, like weather, you know, where it actually matters to them what they wear out that day and things like that. But this is broaden it from weather to including all sorts of biological things, allergens, pathogens, environmental, non-biological environmental hazards and so forth, just kind of packaged together in a way that's entertaining and useful. And that could include things like little envelopes that you have kind of ubiquitously everywhere that, you know, don't require postage. And you just stick whatever you want in there, some envelope you licked or, you know, or something that you found in your backyard, and you put it in there and you don't have to answer any questions whatsoever because where it was postmarked and the sample itself explains everything that needs to be explained.
Interesting.
And then they email it back to you if it gave your email address. I guess you do have to answer that yeah. one question.
So it's kind of, there's a citizen science angle here, right? Where you don't even necessarily need sensor arrays everywhere. You could do this in some kind of, if you had enough people in, you know, one person per neighborhood resolution, you'd be fine, right?
Although sensor arrays would be part of this, as well as things that are already going on, like the CDC and wastewater measurement, My wife and I look at those almost every day for Massachusetts COVID wastewater. Yeah. But it's so specific. It's just COVID. Wouldn't it be great if you just, you know, it's like canary in the coal mine, but a canary that can detect more than just methane.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, I went to the Canary Islands, which are off the coast of North Africa, and a couple weeks ago, and the weather app actually told me that the air quality was really poor because there's basically these things called kalimas, where there's a sandstorm that comes off. They're close enough to the Sahara Desert, I think, that they get these sandstorms. But none of the other weather apps had it. There was just one we looked at that said, "Oh, by the way, the air quality is you're going to be breathing sand."
Well, they have it in towns like L.A. Where the air quality varies. But all of these things are part of weather that are usually neglected. And I think it makes it much more interesting and also more valuable. And we finally have the cost of doing the DNA part of this, you know, for allergens and pathogens down so low that we really could kind of, you know, democratize it.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about viruses more generally. When doing the research for this episode, there was an eerily timed post. I think it was from December 2019. There was an article talking about you talking about the importance of engineering viral resistance into humans. And a month later, we were hit with the global pandemic. And obviously, you've been thinking about this for decades, probably. But what's changed since then? You've been doing a lot of work on this, and it's in the public consciousness a lot more. Than it was then, but the problem hasn't gone away, right? And in many ways, our eyes have been open to how bad this could be round two or round three in the future. Where's your current thinking on that?
Well, one dramatic thing that's changed since then, you're right, we have been thinking about it since around 2002, is how do you make a general solution to the problem of viruses? Because it takes so long to adapt to a new one. I mean, it took us about a year to come up with something decent for COVID-19, and that's like the world record by far in terms of speediness. And the next one might not give us a year, right? So the thing that's happened since that prophecy was that we finally got complete virus resistance for at least one organism. It's the industrial microbe E. coli, so it's of industrial significance. But it also points to a general method. We think we can do it for any plant, animal, or human. And the idea is very simple. It's just you change the genetic code. We essentially swapped a serine and a leucine in the genetic code. And those are very different chemically. And so when you swap those two, the host is in on the game, so it doesn't affect it at all. But the virus is broken in every gene in multiple places. And so it can't really even evolve around it the way it would evolve around, say, you know, a new HIV drug. So that would be the ultimate vaccines. It protects you against all viruses, even ones we've never seen before, all naturally occurring viruses. You can obviously engineer a virus that would get around it, but hopefully nobody would do that. So the challenge for we can do this for plants and animals relatively easily. I mean, it's like 10 times more work, and plus, just in terms of number of base pairs to change, but it's also even more work because they're a little harder to get DNA in and so forth. But anyway, I mean, that something we did, like one little lab on a shoestring did it this year and published in Nature, should be easy to scale up. But then the other hard thing is you only have access to germline for, you know, microbes, animals, and plants. And for humans, you'd have to figure out a way to get it into a large chunk of the cells. Now, if you get hematopoietic stem cells, that makes you resistant to a large category of viruses, and that's relatively easy to do. And if you put it into every transplanted organ, you at least make them better. You know, a lot of transplants are initiated because of infectious disease, you know, hepatitis, so forth, various respiratory infections. So that would be the camel's nose under the tent. But I think with time, we could figure out ways of replacing all kinds of tissues that are not commonplace right now, if the need is great enough, and possibly do it in a form that's like a vaccine, where it's not a surgery, it's just, you know, an injection that where the cells find their to the right place and replace the organ components with new components.
Yeah, and that paper, if people are interested, is the one you're referencing, is a swapped genetic code prevents viral infections and gene transfer. Is that right?
Correct. Yeah.
And what's happening there? You're changing the way that the tRNAs function in some way. Maybe you can explain a little bit about how that works under the hood. And I think you mentioned before that it's something you could do in mammals as well, potentially, right? But you've done it in E. coli first for obvious reasons.
Yeah, you hit it nail on the head. It's tRNA trickery. And I've been working on tRNA now for 51 years, so old friend. And it basically is, there's 64 triplet codons, and lab pioneered changing one of those codons. And then Jason Chen changed that one plus two more. And now we're in the process of changing seven. Changing meaning first you free it up, so you move it to a synonymous codon. So you take every instance of U, C, A, or G, which is code serine, and you switch those over to the other serine, the other four serine codons. And now it's, quote, freed up. And once it's freed up, then you can delete the tRNA for it, which now makes it somewhat resistant to viruses. In fact, we showed it even with the stop codon, just one codon, we can make them resistant to about 80% of viruses. But then there's some viruses that have some tricky things, like they bring in their own tRNA. So the fact you got rid of the host one doesn't help. And so then we took this extra thing of swapping the serine and leucine, and that's not sufficient. You have to make it the tRNA that does that swap abundant enough. It can't be thwarted by viral mechanisms like cleaving the tRNA or bringing in extra tRNA. So we put in a viral tRNA. And that was a critical component and expressed at high levels. Anyway, that results in the host is fine, the virus, all viruses that we've tested. And we even went beyond the lab strains. We went out and got wild viruses from, you know, sewage and farm waste, and found some that brought in their own tRNAs, and none of them have any detectable replication. So I think we got it. And it's completely general, because every microbe, plant, and animal has the genetic code. Not all of them have a virus problem, but a huge fraction of the ones we care about do have a virus problem.
Yeah, there's an obvious direction to go with this, which is around the ethics discussion. But I was thinking, rather than going into the ethics for now of any individual one of these, I was really interested to learn actually about some of your underlying ethical principles. Because when I think about you, I think about someone who pushes the boundaries both technologically and ethically, and you're very famous for, you know, not always having the conventional norms that certainly the popular press have when it comes to things that we should or shouldn't do. And I have the sense that there's a really core set of ethical principles that guide you. For example, you're vegan. I'd love to hear a little bit about the decision there. You know, you're not doing things just because you can or because you feel like it. I think there's some kind of clear set of guiding North Star principles. And I wondered if you had a sense of what those were and where they're different from what might be mainstream today, but could change in the future.
Yeah, I think, again, you hit the nail on the head. Ethics and safety are number one. So ethics is safety and efficacy. That's the sort of the FDA version. And then accessibility, affordability is not really addressed by the FDA, but it is a top priority for us as well. And you're right. We typically do that first. And it probably is easier to discuss it as a general principle than to do it one by one through each of my projects. But almost every project we worked on, at least from my point of view, had some component of safety and affordability that we needed to address up front. And so we almost always publish the ethics, safety, affordability stuff first, and then reveal the, you know, the potentially disruptive in a positive way technology. So for example, when we brought out a method of synthesizing DNA, big DNA from chips, that looked like it might be a 10,000-fold effect and could enable potentially making pathogens. And so we felt, so you start examining, that causes you to, because you're close to it, I mean, I don't think we're particularly more ethical, but we're close to it. And if we feel a responsibility, we say, okay, what could you do about it? And at the time, it was kind of popular to say, well, we're going to have a, you know, code of ethics. Well, that doesn't do any good if somebody doesn't sign it or doesn't mean it when they sign it.
Yeah.
And so I thought that what we needed was surveillance, and in particular, some automated system for surveilling all synthesis. And then that was resisted by the lawyers and synthesis companies because of invasion of privacy of the pharma companies and them being responsible for if anything goes wrong, while they're not responsible if they don't look. Eventually, those objections were overcome, and now it's standard in the field. From 2004 white paper I wrote to today, it's 80-90%, and it hopefully will be 100% soon. Kevin Esfeld and his team have produced a new set of software on top of the old set that I think looks very promising. Anyway, I dwell on that one as an example. I could give other examples for personal genomics and for gene drives and et cetera, but let's go back to the general principles, which is to not assume that everybody is going to sign up for something voluntary. That's the surveillance component. Also, try to think out of the box and to listen to a broad set of voices. Don't just and get that communication going. The real thing is they say, well, scientists should interact with the public. Well, generally speaking, the public doesn't have time. You know, they barely have interest either. Even if you tell them that, you know, they're so used to Chicken Little saying the sky is falling that it's pretty hard to get their attention. And usually when you do, it's on something that isn't a problem. That, you know, it's like, I mean, for example, I think germline engineering is not an urgent public health crisis. It's not even clear that anybody's even made a business model for it or a medical argument for it. It's almost useless. But nevertheless, a huge amount of energy is spent both in science ethics and in reaching the public, while almost nobody is talking about the adjacent thing, which is, you know, you could use somatic cell genetics to make super soldiers actually more easily than you could with germline, because you don't have to wait for 20 years for them to grow up. Right. And it's just a non-issue, partly because there's 8 billion of us that have already missed the deadline for germline. You know, it's like, doesn't apply to us. And so anyway, it's another example I delved into a little bit. So listen to the public in various ways, participate in podcasts like this one. Don't say no to journalists as some kind of knee-jerk reaction. They almost never get it wrong if you get a little bit of practice in what it is and how to talk to them. I mean, I've done hundreds of interviews and essentially none of them. The only ones that go, only time the news gets wrong is when they don't talk to me at all.
Right, right. They take the story and they put their own twist on it. Yeah.
But that's not, I don't complain about that because they didn't do any fact checking. I complain about the fact they didn't do fact checking. But yeah.
But then when the facts are wrong, you're not surprised. Yeah. What about these areas, a lot of the areas that you work in that seem to be the trickiest are the ones where unknowns are kind of core to the question. So gene drives, and maybe you can briefly explain what those are. Same with germline genetic engineering, I suppose, and certainly with the mammoth and bringing back other extinct species. The common objection is we actually don't know what could go wrong because we're tinkering with complex systems. How do you think about those cases and how you protect against that?
I mean, part of it is most of these things are the number of unknown unknowns shrinks the more you think about it and talk about it. And that's why it's really nice to get way out ahead of it. You know, like Jurassic Park started us thinking about the extinction back in 1990. And it's not going to be practical until 2030, let's say 2028 in that range. And even then, So it gave us plenty of time to think about it, think of all the things that go wrong. There still will be things we miss, just like we missed Vioxx, for example, and HRT in the pharmaceutical world. But what you do is you try your best. You maybe over-prepare. It's better to have, too much protection. That's what I was saying earlier about supply chains. And, if we have a little box in everybody's house already for general principles, then we're much more prepared for other things that could be rare. And I love thinking about things that could be rare. You know, these corner cases, they provide us with, we don't want false reassurance. What we want to do is over-prepare. Anyway, so you listed, for germline, again, I think it's surveillance that was missing from the discussion because we now have already had one breach where someone spent 3 years in jail, but he's back out and doing similar stuff. Yeah. The problem was there wasn't, many people knew about it in advance before J.K. Hutt did it. And I think they should have reported it, right? You know, reporting it isn't synonymous with sending him to jail. In fact, they might have saved him from jail since they knew about it before he did it. So they said, well, we didn't know who to go to. That's lame. You go to some random person And and they'll tell you some other random person, and you just keep going around people till you get the right people. I would have started with the FBI, frankly, even though they don't have international clout.
Find the right person, wouldn't they? Pretty quickly.
I mean, I know a bunch of people in the FBI, and that's who I would go to. Or you could go to the head of the FDA or head of NIH, or and it'll probably, the answer will come from one of their subordinates, but still, you tried. You got it on record that you rang the bell. So that was what was wrong there. And there should be, in many cases, there should be a kind of a whistleblower credo that says that that encourages the whistleblower in some way or another, but doesn't encourage false whistleblowing, right?
Yeah.
So
you need that balance.
And the encouragement has to go beyond protecting the whistleblower, because that's not really encouragement. It's like, okay, we're going to put you in a witness protection program for life, you know.
Yeah, great.
You know, hence you're going to be a billionaire. No, you're actually right. Going to be much worse off. So what was the other example you gave in addition to germline?
Gene drives.
So there, the concern with GMOs in general is that they'll spread. Now, in practice, they haven't really spread. In fact, it's hard to make an organism that will survive in the wild, that, you know, that's at all different from what you took from the wild. So now the exceptions, there are two that I know of, and I've worked on both of them. One of them is the virus-resistant E. coli that we talked about earlier, and the other one is gene drives, because virus-resistant E. coli has a selective advantage in that it's resistant to all viruses, and all of its buddies are sensitive. Gene drive have a different advantage. It's not really classical selection where you're selecting on the phenotype. It's a genetic mechanism that causes 100% of the offspring to inherit the drive, the gene drive allele, rather than the normal 50%. And 100% spreads very quickly. It requires sexual reproduction and rapid generation time, which people don't always appreciate when they hear about this. So that means it's limited things like mosquitoes and rodents and, you know, things like that. If you put the wrong, so that's why the first three papers that Kevin Esfeld and I wrote were all about how to reverse it and contain it,
right,
kind of culminating in the daisy chain gene drives, which where if you started on an island where you have the right amount of three different gene drives, you can keep it from going to the mainland, because on the mainland it'll get swamped out by the wild type. That addresses a broad set of unknown unknowns, and that it gives you the control over reversing and containing, even if you don't know what it is the problem that you're dealing with. So that's one way of dealing with the unknown unknowns, is having a general, and in fact, almost any technology you should give some thought to how you reverse it. For example, you know, cell phones, I don't think we have a clue as to how we would reverse people's addiction to cell phones or addiction to OxyContin or a whole bunch of other things. Clearly the war on drugs is not the reversal process that we should have thought about in advance. So that would be one of, you know, you're asking some of my general strategies.
Yes. It's a good way to think about it. So I suppose the woolly mammoth will have some kind of off switch if it looks like it's going to wreck the ecosystem.
That we are prepared for the sense that goats were introduced into Ecuadorian Galapagos Islands long ago, and they've become quite a pest, considering that one of the major sources of income in Ecuador is tourism,
right?
And these things are tromping all over the eggs that the reptiles leave on the ground. Rats are a similar thing in many islands, not just the Galapagos. They eat the bird eggs and the bird young for rare, exotic, beautiful birds and songbirds. So, but they got rid of the goats. Ecuador showed that you can get rid of.
How did they do it?
Anything you can see, you can get rid of.
Give people that, let them hunt, or what do they do?
No, they had to go beyond that. You know, sometimes governments will take the easy way out, which is they just say it's open season on snakes or something. But it usually ends up people killing the wrong thing and not killing the thing they should be, and not getting enough of them. But no, they put trained marksmen in helicopters and just
right.
And goats really can't hide from helicopters. And for rats, they tend to put rat poison down in little packages on the island. However, that's worked on, I think, 100 islands, but there are about 600 more islands to go. And those have problems with, you know, farm animals and humans being on the island, kids and things that don't know not to eat the rat poison. So that's where the gene drives might come in, eliminating the rodent populations that were invasive species.
Yeah, it sounds like it could be a more humane way to do it as well. The idea would be you introduce a rodent population with the gene drive, and then after a couple generations, it minimizes, right? Yeah.
Yeah. And so, as they say in the movies, no animals were hurt in the filming of this movie, right?
Just reproducing. That's all they had. Yeah.
And I think dying of warfarin, which is reduces your clotting ability, is not a pleasant way to go. But
no.
Just having the rat equivalent of birth control is not so bad.
Yes. I want to ask another more general question, which was about your creative process. You're a prolific inventor. You set the record. Let me know if it's not still the record, but I think in 2018, you spun off 16 biotech companies in a single year. You have hundreds of patents, hundreds of companies. I'm interested in what you do. Do things just come to your mind and there is no process, or do you read widely? I'm just really curious to learn about what you do to generate so many interesting ideas.
Well, that's a good question, and probably the short answer is I don't know. But nevertheless, since the question is asked, I think 16Z, Andreessen Horowitz, wrote a thing on what's in the water in the Church Lab.
Yeah.
And so I reflect on it. So the one thing is, I think that people that grow up different in any way, doesn't have to be some specific kind of autism. It's in any way, if you're a little bit chubby, or if you're too thin, or get good grades or bad grades, or whatever it is, it makes you feel different, and then you start thinking different. So that's one thing. And I was different on a number of different axes that we don't need to go into. But so it doesn't have to be some mental gift. It's just being slightly ostracized, and it's not even that. It's not always that painful. So a second thing is listening. So it's just like the ethics conversation we had, it's important for innovation, which is you listen to people and don't discount what they say. Now, very often the people that mention something to you, all they're doing is they're like jogging your creative juices. Yeah. They neither have the idea nor the wherewithal to do it, but it's good to give them credit if you can anyway. And an example of that, just to be concrete, I was interviewed, I think in 2008, by Nicholas Wade. And so I give him credit for this. So, he was doing a story on like a tiny bit of the mammoth genome that had been done by the Penn State University team. And he was trying to figure out if there was more to the story than just some pathetic amount of DNA being sequenced. And he knew that my lab had developed some of the tools that was being used for reading the ancient DNA. And we also developed tools for writing DNA, but not ancient DNA. So he put the two together, which I think is his, maybe he was influenced in turn by Jurassic Park.
Yes.
Because this is 2008, he had 18 years to think about it. And so he asked that, and instead of me saying, look, that's not my department, that's going to look silly if I answer that question, my colleagues will ridicule me. I just said, look, a legitimate New York Times journalist has asked the question, I should try to answer it, even if it's not my field. In a way, it was my field because it brought together two of my things, which were reading and writing DNA. And so I estimated how much it might cost. And I was, as usual, I was underestimating the problem. And then I went off and thought about it and said, we could do this, really could do this. And I should think of what's the right species. It isn't necessarily the first one that was suggested by Nicholas. And then I started digging around and found Sergey Zimov's work on the impact of removing large herbivores from the Arctic, how the negative impact on the diversity of the ecosystem, and in particular, the protection of the, and I was very influenced by that. And I met him shortly thereafter. He and his son came and visited, and then I reciprocated by going to Siberia. I think they got the.
What was that like? Was that? Have you been back?
Siberia. It was amazing. The timing was amazing. It was the first year in history. We didn't know this when we went. It was the first year in history that the summer melt didn't fully refreeze. We saw the consequent. We would go into these deep underground caves that apparently everybody in Siberia builds for storing their summer fish for the one. All the way through. So they don't need a freezer. They just stored underground. But anyway, there was evidence of melt there and so forth. It was also amazing because we had three film crews, mainly because one was on Stuart Brand, who was a pioneer in a number of different fields. And he and I were essentially doing this together. And then the whole business about the permafrost melting and so forth. It's releasing a lot of it in the form of methane. And so you get this dramatic image of going out, poking a little hole through one of the ice in the lakes and holding a match. And it's just, you get this flame coming out of the ice. It's just unforgettable. You can't unsee that. And it's not just the lakes. It's the ground adjacent to the lakes, all the way out into the Arctic Ocean. There's all these methane clathrates at the bottom of the ocean. So it's about 100, 200 times more of that at risk than the carbon that we're worrying about that comes out of our so-called polluters in the human race. So anyway, it's a big deal.
We've mentioned Jurassic Park a couple of times. Have you ever met Michael Crichton or Steven Spielberg? What do they think about your mammoth work if you've had a chance?
Michael, unfortunately, has passed, but he was a medical student at Harvard Medical School. And I have to say, I've read most of his books and admire the way he thinks about things. But I think he should have finished medical school, or at least finished the course on biochemistry, because one of the things that he put in the book, the first book, and the idea is that make all the dinosaurs addicted to lysine in their diet, and then if they escape, then they don't have any lysine. The problem with that is that all microbes, plants, and animals have lysine in them in abundance. It's an essential amino acid, and no matter what food they eat, it's gonna have lysine in it. So it was I don't think he did it tongue in cheek. I don't know what. But he's in good company, because the NIH did a very similar thing. Their guidelines for biocontainment were based on diaminopamelic acid, which is also present all over the place. In particular, it's present wherever E. coli grows, because E. coli has diaminopamelic acid. So there's two examples of how not to do biocontainment. We published an example in 2015 about how to do it, where you use a chemical that is only producible by complicated organic chemistry, right, and doesn't occur in the wild. And that chemical was BIPA, but there could have been any of a variety of organic chemistry produced amino acids, for example. But anyway, the other interesting connection with Jurassic Park that I have is, when it first came out, I saw that a couple of the pages were covered with DNA. And I said, that's pretty rare to have actual DNA sequence filling a page. And so I said, I wonder what that is. They called it dinosaur DNA, but I knew back in 1990, there's no way that was
dinosaur. Didn't have it, DNA.
And so I wrote a program to figure out what it was. Back then, we didn't have BLAST and other great tools. And it turned out it was something I had done as a first-year graduate student together with Greg Sutcliffe, which was the plasmid PBR322. Cool. And he had stuffed in kind of random sequences here and there, but it was 90% it was from this E. coli plasma. I thought that was kind of funny too.
Interesting.
Very far from dinosaur DNA as far as I know.
Is any dinosaur DNA well preserved enough? I know in the story it was in amber or something, but it's way further back than all of the ancient DNA we're used to working with. Is it even possible? What do you think?
I have a principle of avoiding the word impossible
in
my life and my work and my lab. You know, it's too easy to dismiss things. And that's another thing, getting back to your question of how to invent new things, is just, instead of putting it in the trash can, putting it up on the wall where you can say, hey, that's a challenge rather than a piece of garbage. Yeah. Almost everything that I've done has been dismissed by a large number of people as either impossible or useless, or typically both.
That's when you know it's a good idea, right? They tell you it's impossible.
Exactly. That's when I double down. The definition of fanatic is somebody who wants to say, anyway. So your question was?
What would the conditions need to be for preserved you wanted to do the dino version of the mammoth?
So there's two answers. I mean, one is the age keeps slipping, going further and further back. And each time they say, well, this is it. This is as far back as you can go, because we can do these mathematical calculations of decay rate and blah, blah, blah. So at one point, I think it was like 100,000 years was considered some gigantic record. Maybe it was 10,000 before that. And then 200,000. And now I think it's 2 million, which is getting into the range. But then the other answer is, you don't necessarily have to get the DNA to get the answer. So for example, You don't have to get the ancient DNA. So for example, you take modern DNA and reconstruct phylogenetic trees, you can reconstruct the ancestral DNA. And this has been done in a number of groups where they've reconstructed either the common ancestor of ruminant mammals or the common ancestor of all life. And, you know, and they think that those proteins are probably adapted for 65 degrees. So you can actually get information about what life was back then. Now it's hard to get the cis regulatory DNA and RNA is probably going to be a little hard to reconstruct from that method. But again, never say never, you know. Also, then the third way is just by studying modern organisms and studying the bones or whatever you have from the ancient times and figure out what modern mechanisms would it take to make those bones. So again,
yes,
we don't know how far that method can go. So you could basically three methods, which are uncertain in a very promising way.
Fascinating. I was curious, I had a couple more before we run out of time here. I was curious about your decision long ago to become, I think, the first person to basically open source your medical record. You're the fifth person ever genome sequenced. You know, people know that how involved you were. I was wondering whether your position has changed on open sourcing one's medical information through everything you've learned through PGP. Everything yourself, you've been proven right in a lot of ways that it stood the test of time. Nobody has designed a virus to go after you yet or done anything crazy with your data. But I'm wondering what you've learned, because it's been a couple decades, right, since you started this.
Well, this was an interesting exercise in thinking out of the box, too. Not only thinking out of the box of how medical consenting was done, but also what could go wrong. So what is going wrong already and what could go wrong? So what was going wrong at the time I proposed the Personal Genome Project was that people were being consented with the false promise of anonymity. In other words, they said, there's no way that anybody can identify. And they later, partly thanks to my consciousness raising, they watered it down to, well, there are ways, we think they're unlikely.
Yes. But
they were actually quite likely when I raised the alarm, because at the time, you know, things like millions of Veterans Administration and hospital records were getting hacked or lost in the subway and so forth. So, and in fact, the value of medical records was estimated to be 30 times the value of your credit card theft, because credit card you cancel immediately, while all the medical records you can't cancel, you know, things like your mother's maiden name and your social security number and so forth.
You're stuck with them.
Awkward. Anyway. That was the out of the box on what was wrong. Oh, the other thing was wrong in advance was that if you found out something about the patient, you couldn't tell them. So if you found out that all they had to do was take drug X and they'd probably be fine, and they could do that in consultation with their physician, you can't tell them that. You couldn't tell them that back then. And so I felt that if you got the data from them, you could give it back to them as long as they've been proven that they are capable of handling that information. So that's why we put in a requirement to get 100% on an entrance exam. And it wasn't everybody that I think could pass it. So on the side of what could go wrong, if we neutralize those two problems, we put that in the consent, all things we could think of. And one of them was, like you said, a pathogen that got your name on it. Another one was that people could take your DNA and plant it at a crime scene. And we tried to make scenarios that were more risky and maybe even more unlikely, but figuring that if they were okay with those scenarios, they would also be okay with the unknown unknowns that we couldn't list. So the idea was just kind of go over prepared, and then we could handle the unknown unknowns, which, you know, again, was a question you asked earlier that was quite appropriate here too. And so fast forward to today, you ask what lessons were learned. Well, the PGP, I think, has turned out to be a pretty big success. We didn't set out to be the dominant sequencing group. I mean, you know, anytime I want something done at an industrial scale, I launch a company. I don't try to do it academically. Now, there are some academic labs that have tried to compete with industry, but, you know, for either genome sequencing or gene therapy, I just, more power
very
to them. So I hope we will sequence all 8 billion people or the subset that are willing to get educated and sequenced soon because of the commercial components. Because, you know, there's trillions of dollars that could be saved if everybody got sequenced. And that's a separate conversation for why I think that's true. So for the Personal Genome Project, was not successful in being dominating the sequencing field. It was successful in showing that you could test out a bunch of, we tested out almost every technology for all, multiomics, things that are very standard now, which were exceptional. We did viromics, microbiomics, immunomics, proteins, medical imaging, and we didn't make them available for every person, but whatever we got available, we would make it available to the public.
Yeah.
And so it gave the public an idea of, you know, how you would integrate these things, so forth. Also, we became, because we were the one of the only ones that had a consent that consented you for re-identification and for commercial use, those were showstoppers for a lot of projects and commercial use in particular. But we consented them for that. And that turned out to be a good thing. So for example, the NIST, the National Institute of Standard Technology, used our samples in preference over every other sample in the world because of those two clauses. Right. And they're continuing to, they're increasing that, not just for providing DNA standards worldwide. They made tens of thousands of ampules of from trios, mother, yep, father, offspring. But they're expanding it to cell line and so forth. And the cells in the Personal Genome Project have been used for a variety of projects, because even though you might be able to encrypt the DNA information, it's hard to encrypt the DNA in the cell that you're distributing to all these labs. Yes. So again, important to make sure they're okay with it in advance, rather than, you know, coercing them after it's too late, as was done with Henriette Lacks, the HeLa cell line. They sort of, after the fact, they're getting ready to publish it both in Europe and America, and they said to the family, here, sign on this thing. You know, we've already voided your privacy. We just want you to be okay with it. And they actually weren't okay with it, is my understanding, but they signed anyway.
Last question I wanted to leave us with here was your prediction on societal views on genome editing and embryos. This is something we touched on a little bit today. And I have, there's an interesting real world example that episode 59 of our podcast, I had the pleasure of interviewing guy named Daniel Barbin, who lost his father to ALS, found out that he had the C9 ORF72 expansion, and then made the decision to undergo IVF and PGD to try to ensure that he didn't pass the gene, make the expansion onto his child. And I think this is an example that probably a lot of people look at it and say, this feels okay ethically, and I understand here. And I think you've made the point for a long time that we make a lot of decisions on behalf of our children, and genome editing, is in what ways is it different? In what ways is it not? I'm wondering if you could speculate a little bit on how societal views may change over the next decade or two on this as the technology becomes more available as well.
Well, this actually integrates a number of topics we've touched on. I think, so editing is often used as the buzzword for gene therapy more generally, and cell therapy is kind of, I think of as gene therapy done ex vivo and then reintroduced in cellular form. All of these are, I cluster together. But then there's a version of that where it's done in the germline. And I think that ALS, people will come up with arguments for germline, but usually there's a much better alternative. And first I'll talk about the alternative to gene therapy. So I'm heavily involved in advancing gene therapy, but I think a fundamental thing I thought was wrong with the field when I entered it, and I've been working ever since, is just like I helped lower the cost of reading and writing DNA by 20 million fold. We needed a similar thing for gene therapy, because it was the most expensive drug category in history, up to $3.5 million per dose. I think that the misunderstanding or the willful representation is that there is an alternative to the $3 million a dose, which is genetic counseling, which is somewhere around $300 for a lifetime gene counseling. And it's dropping in price. We're figuring out how to ways to automate a lot of the counseling parts, and the price of the genome itself has dropped to $250. It keeps dropping. So that needs to be seriously considered, and we need to think more. It's been a solved problem since the mid-80s, when Doria Shireem showed that you could apply this to at least one community that's willing to adopt it and eliminate or reduce by tenfold, you know, 9 different genetic diseases, like Tay-Sachs, which is devastating, you know, killing kids at 4 years old. It's devastating for the whole family. So there is that alternative to gene therapy in general. And I think in the form of in vitro fertilization, I mean, you can go much earlier and you can avoid all the ethical issues of pregnancy termination and IVF. But IVF is almost the ideal way of dealing with dominant diseases and which you can't really do preconception. And so one of my companies, Orchid Health, has a system by which they sequence every single IVF embryo to find the ones that, since we're only allowed to implant one embryo at a time now to avoid octomoms, a lot of them don't take, you know, and that's kind of gut-wrenching experience, maybe even more so a miscarriage in a normal pregnancy, partly because of the cost and the hormone injections. It's just much more painful process than a typical pregnancy. So with Orchid Health, you can identify the ones that are more likely to succeed in the implantation and developmental process. I think that would solve ALS in almost all, both recessive and dominant diseases, unless you have a vast number of different genetic problems.
It's polygenic and
it's really crazy. Well, polygenic, it could be that if you fix one of the polygenic, it becomes a little less polygenic.
Put something protective in there and clear it out.
A lot of polygenics we live with. I mean, you know, essentially all of us have some polygenic disease. In fact, all of us do have the polygenic disease of dying before we're 120 years old, but we consider it normal.
That's actually a topic that we could probably spend a whole hour on, but maybe I'll follow up in 3 or 6 months and see if you want to talk about that. I mean,
we have a strong program in aging reversal, but back to the germline, I think that can be avoided by genetic counseling, in particular IVF, if you have a dominant allele. But the other thing about it is it really, in including that, there's really no argument for it, is that there's, you know, like I said, 8 million of us are past the point where it would be a benefit to us. It might be a benefit to the small number of babies that are born each year, but there's alternatives that are much more cost effective.
Yeah, amazing. Well, thank you. I'm amazed at actually how much ground we managed to cover, and it's a testament to how much you've thought about all these areas. So thank you so much for the time and for sharing this with us.
Yeah, well, thank you. It was a very enjoyable interview, and you hit on some angles, I think.
My pleasure.
Really articulated the way you did. So
good. That was my hope. I've been hoping to interview you for a long time. You obviously have had a prolific career. So thanks again.
Yeah, thank you.
That wraps up this week's episode of the Genetics Podcast. I'd like to give a huge thank you to our guests for sharing their valuable insights and experience. And thank you as well to our listeners, as always, for tuning in. If you enjoyed today's talk, the number one thing I would really appreciate from you is if you could share it with a friend or colleague who you think would enjoy it as well. We would also really appreciate if you could subscribe to our show and give us a quick rate and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast platform. Both of these things help us become more visible when people search for Genetics and Precision Medicine podcasts. And we're always eager to hear from you. Please reach out to us with any questions or feedback on social media. You can find Sonogenetics on Twitter, LinkedIn, or visit sonogenetics.com. Finally, a big thank you to the team behind the scenes who make all this possible, in particular, Amy Cousins and Sonia Shah, who produced the show, and James Pierce from Selective Frequencies, who handles the audio engineering. I'm Patrick Short, your host, and it's been a pleasure. Thank you, and we'll see you next time on the Genetics Podcast.